Okay, so welcome back to Fictropology. And we are here again with the four usual suspects. That would be me, Luconi, and let's see, Alanya.
Hello.
And Aaris.
Sup.
And Neri.
Hey.
Sound more enthusiastic, please.
Hey, woohoo, yeah!
All right, thanks. Okay, so this week we are tackling the economy of fandom, or social economy, maybe you might want to call it. We have two articles, one from the glory days of 1992, which is The Cultural Economy of Fandom by John Fiske. And then we're going to zoom ahead to 2009 with A Fanish Field of Value, Online Fan Gift Culture by Karen Hellickson, which I think we've heard of. We've heard from her previously in other incarnations. But yes, so we're going to talk about all of those. So do we want to start with the older one first?
I think we should start with the older one because I think it provides a lot of good jumping off places to then get into the Hellickson.
Okay. So does anyone want to do a little summary of the Fisk?
I could sort of give you the breakdown.
Okay. Please do.
All right. So in The Cultural Economy of Fandom, John Fisk is essentially looking at how fans deal with economic and cultural capital. And when we say fan, he is using not just the fandoms that we swim in, the sort of media-based fandoms, but he includes a lot of music-based fandoms and sports and comic books. He's talking about fans in general, as we know of. And he begins with God, I shouldn't
Bourdieu.
To say that. Bourdieu. Yeah, I'm so bad at French. I'm sorry. He begins with Bourdieu, okay. and looking at Bourdieu's discussion of taste and how taste overlaps with economic status and social space. And then he essentially differentiates between what we can call, think of official culture, which is the dominant narrative culture, and then the subordinate culture, or the popular culture, which is where most of the sort of fanish spaces are born.
Right.
And he points out that Bourdieu talks about cultural capital within the economic axes and in how cultural capital and economic capital can go together. But then he decides to look at fandom and how fans construct cultural capital, and he makes the point that it's actually quite difficult for fans to translate cultural capital into economic capital. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a cultural economy going on and that it doesn't follow some of the principles that also control the dominant culture and how that gets capital there gets amassed, and he goes through a couple. He gives you a lot of explanations from a couple different fandoms, and it's not explanations, examples,
right?
And he looks at the different types of. He looks at essentially three different sort of ideas in popular culture: discrimination and distinction. Then he looks at productivity and participation. And then finally, he looks at capital accumulation and how these ideas function and become part of the process of how cultural capital is accumulated in popular cultural fandom.
Right.
So it's, I'm not sure if he sets out to, if he does everything that he sets out to do, but it's certainly a nice thing to have a, to have such a clear and concise theoretical model that you're following.
Yeah.
Right.
Because all the terms are nicely defined, at least for me.
Yeah, I found that was true also. One of the other things that he does is that he expands Bourdieu's model.
Yes.
Bourdieu is mostly looking at economics and class. as the dimensions of social discrimination, I guess is the term he's using. Mm-hmm. And he, Fisk, is adding class, gender, and age also
and race.
As what he calls. No, he talks, he does not use race. He acknowledges that race is a factor, but he doesn't actually.
But he does mention the Latin.
Yeah, he acknowledges that it's important, but that he doesn't have any reference material to draw from in regards to that
factor.
He calls them axes of subordination. So he basically says that he has not, when he was writing this in 1992, that he had not found studies of non-white fandom. So that he wasn't able to comment on that from a scholarly point of view, not having the resources to talk about it appropriately, I guess.
Right.
In an academic sense.
Yeah.
I wonder if nowadays, with all the work that's been done on urban music and the rise of rap and hip hop, if that work could be done.
Yeah, I wonder. I haven't really seen any studies on that type of fandom, but there must be some.
Oh, yeah, there must. They probably are just not couched in those kinds of terms.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
It's not recognized as being a fan, that type of fan engagement, but maybe part of being a broader cultural identity issue.
Yeah.
Because rap is constructed from a different. Like, it's constructed differently socially.
Right. But, I mean, Fisk used examples of, like, Madonna fans and then how they dressed and how they behaved and how that kind of developed out of their love for Madonna and their wishing to be like her. So, I mean, I would imagine there's treatments like that of rap fans and how that translates into social behavior.
I do think that rap has a slightly different history in terms of how it became to be part of a larger music scene. Like, its cultural roots are still, like, people can still engage it in it at that, or with it rather, at that level as well. That makes it slightly different from more produced. Well, I guess it is still pretty produced these days, but
it kind of is.
Yeah.
I feel like you can use the same type of study as you might on Madonna fans. You're gonna get different data.
Yeah.
But you could still do it.
Yeah, one thing that I liked about at one point he was talking about Madonna fans and looking at their similarity to, say, English soccer fans.
Yeah, that was interesting.
And how this, although one is predominantly male and one is predominantly female, both encourage an assertiveness, almost a standing up to the voices of authority, be it the police, be it the parents, be it the, you know, the community leaders who are upset about morals and yada, yada, yada.
Right.
And both people use these fandoms, be it football or Madonna, in order to sort of construct their own identity in defiance of the sort of dominant narrative, even if they didn't necessarily realize they were doing it.
Yeah.
Satisfied a need.
And I think that was a section where he got at issues of age, of the age issues the most. Well, he doesn't make it as explicit as he could. And he managed to talk about them using it as youthful rebellion a lot without actually ever using the phrase youthful rebellion, which was
I was curious, like, the section about Madonna reminds me, to some extent, I wanted to try to think about what the connections are between that sort of music fandom and, like, bandom or, you know, music RPF.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I mean, I guess I don't... I don't know what the young people today are doing.
One Direction is huge.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But I mean, do fans of musicians today go to that same extent of, like, dressing like the musician, you know?
Yeah.
They go into that same level of, like, wanting to really be like them. I guess Bieber hair, yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think that exists on a lot of different levels. You do have the Justin Bieber stuff and, you know, the more sort of commodified produce, the Disney princess sort of, you know, young pop singer. But then even as you look at more independent labels,
hipsters.
Ways of dressing, hipsters and people who say they're not hipsters, but looking awful lot like hipsters to the rest of us. There are ways of dressing.
Fans of indie music and their vintage clothing.
Mm-hmm. Yes. There are ways of dressing and constructing social identities that, you know, I do think mimic what we see in Madonna. It's not at, I don't think it's as visible as...
That's not true. I disagree. I mean, I think if you look at sort of the... if you want to go back to my day and age when we were doing the goth thing, that was very much related to a music-based identity. And it's the same with people with younger generations who are doing the emo thing now. to make myself sound really
doing
old.
The emo thing 5 years ago,
doing
maybe?
5 years
well,
ago.
Yes, but, I mean, even so.
Yeah, oh no, I agree with you with goth, definitely.
Yeah.
Hipster, but the thing
you
is,
see
I
Lady Gaga fans don't really dress like Lady Gaga, at least on an everyday basis.
But they do incorporate a lot of her messages in other ways. I mean, the teenage sections of the Lady Gaga fandom are huge, and they use her music in a very self-empowering way, especially if they, you know, don't fit the sort of heteronormative understanding of gender or sex.
Right. But then, see, Fisk was talking about different ways to express your fandom, and so you have your semiotic level, and then you have the enunciative. And then you have the textual. So the textual would be like writing fan fiction and talking in public, but the enunciative is dressing like somebody, and then you signify to the people around you that you're affiliated with that artist. And so I don't really see that so much, at least in my limited view of DC.
Well, Lady Gaga, well, her fans, who they her baby monsters or her little monsters or whatever, they are definitely the enunciative producers. I don't see the same level of, say, textual production as he gives with the example of the Madonna vid competition, the Madonna fan vid competition,
right? Which was hilarious.
Yes,
but
I'm just shocked at the idea of, you know, MTV showing a full day worth of music.
Yeah, they used to do that way back in the day.
Yeah,
it did happen
when I was a kid. Let me tell you.
I actually have something that I want to talk about. What Alanya brought up when she was looking at this idea of age as being one of the axes that we can look at, axes of subordination. On page 36, Fisk kind of combines age and gender.
Right.
And talks about how the, you know, if we say that the female is the subordinate and the younger age is the subordinate. In general, older males are going to use more of the sort of official language, the sort of aesthetic appreciation, even within pop culture,
right.
as part of their discourse on fandom. Whereas if you, the more you skew young, the more you skew female, you're going to see more of, say, the subordinate, the language of the proletariat, fitting the criteria for popular culture. And not necessarily the dominant narrative.
But do you think that can be turned on its head? Like, that
yes.
The things that older white males tend to like are the things that are esteemed in sort of official culture.
Yes, I do. I actually think that, you know, and that even if they're esteemed in official culture, the older white males are going to, and maybe are trained to, associate them with the things that are esteemed in official culture, like the comic book fans who talk about the artistic integrity of certain drawers or writers, or say you see this in sports fans, right? Sports fans define themselves, like right now statistics is huge. And a lot of sports fans, you know, they're not in it just to jump and woo. They want to essentially, they have their fantasy baseball teams, or they're you know, they're stats geeks, and they're using this knowledge, which is very mathematical, and which is correlated in the real world with very high prestige, high making jobs in the sports market, and they associate themselves with that and not with the like guy who's painted blue screaming in the stand. So I think there's something like this going on. And then when I was reading this, something clicked in me, and that this is why men don't write fanfic. And I'm going to tell a story from my personal life, and some of you guys may have heard this story before, and I don't think, you know, I don't think Neri has. But when I was dating a guy once, and he found out that I wrote fanfic, he was a huge fan of stuff. Like he was definitely a fanboy. We shared a lot of similar tastes in media and books and all this stuff, right? But the minute he found out I wrote fanfic, he was immediately distrustful of it. Like, he couldn't comprehend why I would want to do that. And I could never explain it to him. He was just like, well, why don't you just write real books? Or why don't you just take all this time and go off and like, write something that's publishable?
Right.
He couldn't wrap his head around the fact that I wanted to participate in a community and in an activity that didn't necessarily align itself with a dominant sort of privileged hierarchical understanding
right.
of these texts. And
something that's not monetized in that way. Like
yeah.
Yeah, and when Fiske says, the less a fan suffers from these structures of domination and subordination, the more likely he or she is to have developed a habitus that accords in some respects with that developed by the official culture, and will therefore inclined to use official criteria on its unofficial texts. And I think a lot of straight men, a lot of heterosexual men, don't understand why women would write slash, because they've never seen themselves as sexually subordinate.
Right.
And I'm not sure if this solves my whole why aren't there any men on my live journal question, which I've never been able to satisfactorily answer. But as much as I'm not a structuralist, this particular explanation rings true to me and sort of provides a little bit of a key towards unlocking a couple social interactions that I've had with male fans about fan fiction and slash in general.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Am I just essentializing everything too much, or what do you guys think about this?
I think that there are ways that men engage with fandom that that's Pirate Lanny speaking. That still subvert dominant hierarchies, but they're different. Like, I think a lot about in terms of male fandom enterprises being, for example, how guys relate to video games.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know I've talked about before about, you know, guys who will literally make entire video game sequels. And so you've got that technological privilege there
mm-hmm.
as well, that also, again, speaks to the more dominant
or like
culture.
Minecraft Westeros.
Yes, like what,
like they're
Minecraft Project.
Building the entire world of Westeros in Minecraft.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm sure that's not all guys working on it, but it does seem like a fairly male-centric thing to do.
Yeah, and right. I mean, you know, people who make skins and mods and so forth for different video games as well, like those are mostly male fans, as far as I'm aware, and I could be generalizing horribly, but that is my understanding of it. But that the kinds of ways that men take the authoritative text and transform them are still, I mean, they're engaging with it in a very broad way in similar ways, where they're taking it and they're transforming it, they are certainly creating fan works in a broad sense, but that their levels of engagement, you know, they're engaging more with the technology that creates these texts and these games or whatever, and less like, I'm interested in the storylines.
Right.
I want to hear about these characters. It's at a different level.
Do you think there's a certain amount of masculine competition that goes on with some of those technologically based fan activities, where they're like, I'm going to look more badass than anyone because I've done this and I've done that, where I don't find that as much in fan fiction writing, where people just want to write really good stories, and some do go all out and write huge epic ones, but it's not necessarily like I'm in a competition to write the best story, where they feel like sometimes the programming and technology based ones more.
To some extent, I'm jumping ahead to the next article now, but I think to some extent you could argue that it comes from the same impulse as writing fanfic, maybe, in that it's sort of like you want to participate in the community and you want to make these things that people will say, that's really cool, that they'll say, I really like mm-hmm. this, and this is an awesome thing, and, you know, people will admire you for having created this.
Right.
So to move beyond this sort of enunciative productivity to textual productivity in John Fiske's terms.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, people feel encouraged to do that. The fandom in general encourages people to make that leap. It nurtures that impulse.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, because it is this built-in community that is going to, you know, receive the products that you make and hopefully like them and, you know, tell you you're good.
Right.
Can I jump in here mm-hmm. for a second with something that's a little bit derailed, but I really want to say it. I don't want to forget that I wanted to say it. But when he was talking, or even in the sections where that Aeris was talking about before on page 36, when he's talking about how depending on what levels of privilege you have sort of dictates how you might engage differently and like the levels at which you're willing to engage with popular cultural forms from the perspective of a more like accepted official culture mm-hmm. point of view. Mm-hmm. And it really to take us to the next extra level of meta step, it made me think of what we are doing here as this project and what and comments that Lucconi has made before about how when she was doing research about making this podcast, the only people she could find talking about fandom from an academic perspective in podcasts were men.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't know why that is.
No, Well, we are pretty high up on Bourdieu's sort of cultural capital. A lot of us are very, very west in the academic section, and we may not necessarily be very north. We're not sort of exceptionally wealthy, but
yes,
but we do have a lot of education, and even though we don't have inherited social capital, we have acquired a lot of social capital.
Right.
Right.
So. For us, I think it was very natural when the notion of a podcast was first broached. We ourselves, as privileged fans, sort of saw this as a natural outlet to discuss some of the ideas, to engage in fandom in a level that's not just, you know, reblogging things on Tumblr, you know, reading fic on AO3.
Right.
So it's not just, I mean...
And it is adopting a format from... academia, from the official culture, by, you know, reading articles and analyzing them is exactly what we do in grad school, and then we just adapt it.
Yeah, I actually wanted to talk about that, which is that I have a question. All of us have been in some form of graduate school, correct?
Correct.
Yes. Correct.
Have you ever been in a place where there's a higher chance of randomly running into a fellow fan than academia?
No.
I mean, unless you're like,
well,
unless you're at a
shop.
Convention.
Gaming store? Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
But a gaming store, that is pretty much the manifestation of a fandom, right? The physical manifestation of a fan place.
Right.
That's a fanish space in the real world. Academia, yeah. I think, like, I have a note here that fans sort of choose to align themselves with different levels of sort of dominant or subordinate in order to construct a differentiated habitus. And I specifically think about how fans in academia behave with each other. How the professors, right, insist on a certain type of discourse. But mm-hmm. when you take the professors away, how quickly the graduate students switch that discourse. They use the terms from that discourse, but then they will go and talk about fanish stuff.
Right.
And I was just talking to a friend of mine from graduate school, and lo and behold, I realized, like, I didn't know this before, but she was telling me about her blog. I realized she's a BNF in the Bleach fandom. And I was just started thinking about this, and I was like, you know, I walked into graduate schools, and it was just full of fans. Sometimes it were movie fans or music fans, and sometimes it was, like, the internet-based media participatory culture, we write fanfic fans.
Right.
And I have never seen anywhere else that they congregate in real life so readily.
Right. Well, I think part of that is the writing skills that it takes to be a producer in the fanfic world is you have the more time for it in some respects, or especially when you're procrastinating doing other assignments.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're developing your analytical and writing skills as a at least in the humanities and social sciences. I don't know about the chemistry folks and stuff, but...
Oh, they're definitely... They're developing other skills, but...
Yeah.
But they're all fans, too.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I mean, there's a certain amount of that. That's not an intimidating place for us to go compared to someone who maybe has less of an education and they might feel more intimidated by trying to write a story. Does that make sense?
But here's a question. Do you think that graduate school in general encourages fanish behavior because graduate students find themselves in a subordinated position to their professors and bosses?
I think it encourages obsessive analytical behavior.
That's true.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking.
I don't know. It was just a thought as I was reading. I was like, wow, this explains so much about every single graduate department I've ever been part of.
Well, we do stuff that we don't necessarily realize why we're doing it. So it might have something to do with that. And sometimes it's just a break from stress. Honestly,
that's,
you know,
true.
It's a fun topic to engage with instead of a hard or dry or difficult topic.
But then you're still taking that knowledge and that social capital that you have from having this knowledge of how to be more critical of the text you're engaging with.
People who finish their dissertation and turn around and finish a 16,000 word fanfic.
Yeah.
Not that anybody here has done that.
Never.
Not in the past week, no.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, well, I thought it was interesting that Fisk, I think essentially both Fisk and the Helixon come down to the idea that even though there's not really a monetary value involved with this behavior, that it contributes to the participant's self-esteem, and that is essentially what the cultural capital is getting you.
Mm-hmm.
And how that it seems true to me in many respects. As a writer, you do feel like more in control and better about the world when you've finished a story, and especially if people like it and respond to it, and that makes your general everyday life seem better, even if you're not suddenly getting a $10,000 a year raise, but you're still like happier.
I have skills that people appreciate.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. Which I thought was an interesting way to look at why this is so many people spend so much time on this without getting economic reward, but they do get psychological reward essentially, and that's
cultural.
Important.
Yeah.
Well, to switch over to the Helixon, I think we can go back to the Fisk later, but I do want to sort of pursue this idea of what Helixon posits as what people are getting out of this, because I think it's slightly more complex than self-esteem. And this is where she comes into this idea of people's gifts are themselves.
Are you going to give us a summary of her paper?
Oh, all right. So, break.
Yeah.
Now, a fanish field of value, online fan gift culture. Karen Helixon is essentially looking at the role of the gift in fan culture. And she starts by looking at the sort of elements related to the gift, which is the giving of the gift, the receiving of the gift, and then the reciprocation of the gift, and how this is an inherently anti-commercial sort of structure.
Mm-hmm.
And she says that that this notion of the gift is pretty much central to fan economy. So we can look at fan economy as a type of gift exchange. But then she starts looking at what the gift actually consists of, the types of gifts that can be given, effort gifts, object gifts, even, I don't know, thought gifts, symbolic gifts, and how they derive their value. And that their value is not just giving someone that you like something that's awesome if for the enjoyment of all, but that sort of underneath that is that this idea of giving sort of creates the fanish community. And when you participate in this sort of process of giving and receiving and reciprocating, you are being initiated into a gift economy which rejects sort of capitalist notions of value and worth. And, you know, it all comes down to this. The fan work, she says, is an element of symbolic exchange where all forms of value are negated and sort of, you know, writer and reader give back to each other, feedback loops, and then rewriting and transforming into this feedback loop of gift exchange, she calls it.
Mm-hmm.
And how that sort of is the glue that holds the community together. Then she goes and starts linking it with gender. And this is where, for me, the article stops seeming sort of... And it's not that it loses cohesion. Like, I get how she gets from this first part to her construction of a gendered community part. But this is where I stop nodding along and start going, really?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That was my big problem, too, was her the way that she brought gender into it does not jive with my understanding of, again, like I was talking before, how males also engage with this production of fanish objects that are gifts in a very similar way, but they're just not operating the same realm of fandom.
She reads sort of capitalist exchange as exclusively masculine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I definitely don't agree with. And that and symbolic exchange or gift exchange as exclusive as sort of like as feminine, which anyone who's ever studied anthropology, no.
Right.
Yeah. I felt that whole basis from which she's beginning to operate in that section is false to me.
Yeah.
As you've just said, like that this is male, this is female, and therefore females are claiming power by doing this other kind of thing that's not male. And I mean, it goes back to me to like the whole, well, men and women have different kinds of power, but women's power is just as valid. And I mean, yes, but that's not, I don't think it's what's going on here. I don't think that we really do have two different kinds of power networks. This is the men's network and this is the female or women's network. Like, I don't see that happening at all.
Right.
And then I just think that her perceptions of how that all fits together is very simplistic.
And I like the idea that a symbolic exchange essentially becomes the giving of the self, because I think that on some level is true.
Yes.
You're offering yourself up for approval, and because it's a gift, the receiver understands that, you know, pretty much everything is gravy. They could have gotten nothing. So whatever you give them, they think is awesome.
Right.
Right? For the most part.
Ideally.
I think...
I wished she had in some way gone into, or maybe it's, you know, maybe it was beyond the scope of her article, but the sense of, like, scorekeeping that goes on in the gift exchanges of fandom, where it's sort of like, I mean, I know I do it too, where it's like, well, I remember that person wrote me a really nice story, and so I want to make them something because, you know, I like them, or they did this nice thing for me, and I want to do something back for them. Mm-hmm.
Do you do negative scorekeeping?
Well, I was going to say, I mean, that's the sort of benign form of it,
right?
But then you could look at things like Yuletide Cole, where
that's what I was thinking,
where it's like, basically an anonymous community designed to complain about gifts that were perceived to be inadequate or not, you know, well produced in some way.
Except that I think Yuletide is interesting because although we've set up in Yuletide a place where people exchange gifts freely, there actually does become value associated with these gifts, right? If you get like a super long, awesomely well-developed fanfic, right, for the small fandom that you requested, right, that feels great. If you get like a little snippet with like maybe one character that you requested doing something that you really actually don't like, you're like, well, thanks for writing me this, but you basically wrote this yesterday, right? Or you didn't pay attention to what I wanted. So we've actually set up a social structure within fandom space, or an economic structure within a fanish space, where people do have expectations.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it's just not a monetary value.
Of the reciprocation. It's not a monetary value, but value does exist there.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting the way the Yuletide community has always refused to make official the sort of standards, because how can you enforce it? You know, you can't police, did you get a good story?
Right.
All you can police is, did you get a story that met the minimum requirements of length and included the characters that you wanted?
Right.
But yet there's this perception among the people who participate, I think, that not following the optional details, you know, which are optional, is not really optional.
Yeah.
And people, I mean, I think if people at least are putting themselves into it, they're going to try to meet those, you know, requests, no matter how foreign or weird they may seem when you get them and you sort of go, oh my God, what did I offer to write here? But, you know, if you can't manage it, then, you know, you feel like you're letting the person down. And there's this whole sort of guilt
and shame,
I guess. Yeah, I wasn't going to say shame, but I think it's shame caught up in what is supposed to be essentially a pleasurable activity.
It's guilt until you post it, and then it's shame.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, it gets more complex than that, because I know people who will, for example, go and see what all their, you know, how the person that they are writing for has previously participated in Yuletide. Like, have they been a good gifter for the people that they have written for? Have they been a courteous receiver of gifts? Like, and they'll take all that into account, into how much effort they want to put into the story that they're writing for this person.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if they get assigned to somebody they know is kind of, you know, kind of a troll or whatever, they, you know, or that they know has been really rude or whatever. Or, and, you know, it might even go outside of Yuletide. Like, if somebody is known in their particular corner of fandom in a particular, like, to have a certain reputation that's negative, you know, that they might bitch about being assigned to that person or what have you. So there's all of these really complex factors that go into how do I write a story for somebody that's really, when the basic rules are pretty simple and straightforward.
Right. I mean, right. So I guess I think it's more complex than what Hellickson is illustrating here, where she presents it as kind of like, gifts bond our community together. And I'm like, well, yes, I guess, but they also...
Well, she only has like a page and a half.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. I wish it was a longer article.
It is very short, yeah. And, you know, I don't know if she had the space to get into all of this, but I think it's more complex than just saying that by exchanging gifts, people build their community. I mean, I guess that's true, but there are also sort of negative aspects to the gift exchange model.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Can I pull out a quote here? On page 116.
Yes, sure.
This is one. She says, the goal of community building transactions in online media fandom is the creation of a stable space set apart by implementation of rhetorical strategies that exclude outsiders from what fans call real life to permit performance of gendered alternative queered identity.
I agree with that to some level. I'm not sure if it's the goal, but I do think that one of the effects of this community building in media fandom is that people can perform different genders than and experiment with gender and identity in a way that they may not be able to in quote-unquote real life.
Mm-hmm.
I remember at my very first convention, which was a tiny convention in New York for a bunch of Smallville fans, we were all sitting around a hotel room talking and drinking. It was awesome. And one girl like pauses and she goes, "You realize we're a bunch of straight women getting each other off." And almost looked around at the room and were like, "Yep, we're okay with that." Like, it did, but that, you know, it's out there. I mean, it, you know, fandom is a place for people to perform and to experiment and you know, it is a safe space that has in it, and I think the, you know, it's cheesy to say the gift binds us together, but on some level, the fact that you put yourself out there and that's received well,
right?
If yourself is the gift, that when you want to go out and experiment and perform and try new things and maybe do something that you wouldn't do in real life, fandom is a great space to do that in. Whether it's online fandom or Rocky Horror Picture Show or painting yourself blue when screaming at a sports game,
right? Well, but one of the things in that statement was the exclude outsiders issue, which,
yes,
I think goes with Neri's, the downside of fandom, because there is definitely an aspect of, you know, you don't know this fandom well enough. You even just the abbreviations of couples that they come up with is very exclusionary if you don't know what they're talking about. Especially, well, one of my earliest fandoms was Gundam Wing, where everybody had numbers because their names were based on numbers, and so then you had like 1x2 and 3x5 and you're like, what is going on? And, you know,
it's not so much a fandom as a math test.
And then you get the people who are like, you can only use times if there's sex involved, and you use plus if it's not sex, and then you've got the plus and the minus and the, oh my god, it's just, it's...
Oh please, in yaoi fandoms it's all like the first person you mention has to be the seme and the second person you mention has to be the uke,
right?
And, you know, this is this and that is that.
Right.
And oh, definitely, there is.
And then you get 3 equals 4 because it's a reciprocal relationship. You're like, give it a rest. Just tell me who's involved in the pairing. I don't care. I'll figure it out from the story. But there's a certain amount of exclusion in using those abbreviations, because if you're not in on what all of those things mean,
yeah,
you feel left out and you feel sort of like you're not invited to the party.
And you have no idea what's going on.
And you have no idea what's going on.
You're like, who am I reading about? What's going on?
I don't know who these people are.
Yeah, I mean, it makes it hard to find things that you want to engage with, too, if you don't know the codes.
Yeah, so I think it's not just about excluding outsiders from real life, but it's about excluding or, you know, creating this boundary that people have to pass in order to get in kind of thing.
Yeah, you need your geek cred for each fandom.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You need to...
But Fisk talks about this when he talks about discrimination and distinction and how, like, you know, it's not just the boundary between fan viewers and mundane viewers, but, you know, even if you're like, which Doctor Who do you like?
I love that. Amazing. This article is from 1992, so he's like, oh yeah, Doctor Who fandom is hugely divided between the new series, you know, post Tom Baker.
That was awesome.
That was really funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, and do you have access to certain types of information? You know, I know that for me growing up, I could never really participate because I never had an allowance. So, like, the idea of me buying comics would have been comical. No, but seriously, I couldn't have asked my parents, like, hey, X-Men, can I go buy X-Men? They would have been like, no. Why?
Why are you wasting
And I can't be like, because Rogue is my hero. Right? I couldn't have done that. That wouldn't have flown in my household.
Right.
So I had to sort of like make do with stuff that you could borrow from the library, which is why my first big giant real fandom was Lord of the Rings.
Right. Which is a culturally acceptable fandom.
It was culturally acceptable, and then they made a movie of it while I was in high school, and all of a sudden my investment in that fandom and in that text,
cultural capital,
it translated into prestige like nothing you would ever believe. People would come up to me in the halls of my high school and be like, so what's going on in this book? Or they would come to me and say, hey, talk to us about this because we just saw the movie and we want to know what we should read. It was so weird. I went from being, you know, it didn't salvage my reputation in any real way, but it did give me prestige and in
cultural capital.
In cultural capital. Like, the investment paid off.
Right. You just never know what's going to be the next official fandom that becomes popular.
I think Mary's been on the negative end of that to some extent.
Damn you, Game of Thrones. I hate you.
Oh.
I mean, I'm sure it's a lovely show and so on. Get out of my fandom.
Get out of my fandom.
No, it's okay. I'm not really that bitter, just a little.
So Neri, is there a strong, I mean, I never really sort of played in the Game of Thrones fandom aside from the enunciative sort of talking at Alanya about things.
Mm-hmm.
But is there a strong response among the book-based fans who are maybe pissed off about how certain things are going in the show?
Yes. Yes, is the short answer. And some of them are able to sort of put it aside and say, okay, this is just a totally separate thing.
Right.
And I can appreciate it on its own terms, but I'm not going to pretend like these are the same characters from the book, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, I guess, are like me and won't do that. And I've seen some complaints recently from people saying, I wish people would stop tagging your fix with Song of Ice and Fire and Game of Thrones when you're basically just using characterizations from one.
Right.
Like, people are tagging with both because they want to get the broader audience or whatever, or because they see them as indistinguishable. But when they're really using mainly the TV show, for instance, to base their characterizations of certain characters, I think some people, especially who are sort of older fans or who've been in the book fandom longer, come to that and are like, oh, this wasn't really what I wanted to read at all. You know, this is the TV show. And it's really basically a different character. You know, the book version of Cersei would never do that or whatever. So I think there is that split to some extent between the sort of book fans who've been around the fandom for, you know, a decade or more, and the people who've just come to it because of the TV show more recently. And, you know, maybe they have read the book in order to, you know, get caught up or whatever, join in with the broader fandom. But the TV show is still sort of the canon text in their head, and so that's the way they are going to approach their fic.
I think there's a certain amount of that attitude of this stay out of my fandom attitude for all sorts of fans. Because
yeah.
like, you know, like when the Patriots suddenly won the Super Bowl for like the first time in forever.
Oh, please. And the Patriots? Talk about the Red Sox. The very term pink hats. Do you remember this?
No.
All right. So when the Red Sox won the World Series for the first time in like forever in 2004, essentially the Red Sox, the front office and the money behind the team realized that, you know, in general, you know, teams experience an increase in revenue after they win a national title, mm-hmm. but that the Red Sox fandom had such a powerful narrative associated with it. You know, the underdog, the cowboy, the, you know, the guys who stood up to the empire, you know, that they could pretty much coast on that for, well, let's see, it's 2012, 2013, almost a decade.
Right.
So they just started producing tons and tons of stuff. And one of the things that they did is they tried to reach out to female fans, not realizing that they already had plenty of female fans.
Who were perfectly happy without pink hats.
And they made hats in different colors, and they specifically made hats in pink in order to reach out to female fans to get them to buy baseball hats, which some fans were like, woohoo, I love pink, give me a hat. And some non-fans were like, well, I'm not a big baseball fan, but I have to go to this game now, so sure, I'll buy a pink hat. But a lot of men, male fans, started using the term pink hats to mean bandwagon fans. And it was very much gendered female.
Mm-hmm.
Where like, these women are just into it because they think this is a team that wins all the time, or they want to hang out with their boyfriends while they watch the game, and that's why the pink hats are out there.
Right.
And it is horribly offensive, and it reflects, you know, the sort of like the inner fandom's frustration with the bandwagons, the Johnny Come Latelys.
Right.
But it also is the like, this is a male space. What the heck are you women doing here?
Yeah, I guess it gets
can't
both.
Can't you code yourselves as male at the very least? Come on, wear a navy blue hat.
Right.
My hat is green. But I'm not sure what that means.
But I mean, I would, you know, you just hear, even without the gender issue of the people who've been diehard fans of Patriots, Red Sox, what have you,
yeah.
who, you know, are suddenly inundated with all these people going, yeah, I love that team. And you're like, you haven't even heard of this team until 2 years ago, or, you know. That's not an uncommon attitude of just being like, you guys are fair weather fans, or you are coming at it from a very different space and you don't have the history that we have because we've been going mm-hmm. to the game for 15 years or 20 years or 30 years and you don't know all the changes in the team.
We've been sitting in the stands and watching our team blow the ninth inning lead so many times.
Exactly. And so, and especially, and then with something like Song of Ice and Fire, where you're like, those are really, really big, long books. And so you've put the work in.
Or the people who are like, oh my God, I can't wait 6 months for the new episodes to come out. And I'm like, shut up.
Well, you know what I want to say, shut up for? People are like, God, there's so many characters. I can't keep them all.
No.
I'm like, what? No, if you can't keep them straight, stop reading. Like, you're clearly not smart enough to read this book.
There's a list at the back, eh?
Yeah, there is a list at the back. There's a
you
list
can
at the back,
refer to that
and there's like a million primers online.
Right.
There's a wiki.
There is a wiki.
There's a wiki.
Like, you know.
Right.
To bring this back to our articles again.
Thank you.
What? This was about articles?
Yeah. Strangely, at some point, there was even two of them in here.
Wow.
But to go back to Fisk again, I think, what I find interesting, like, because he creates this idea of the official and the, or he doesn't create, he uses Bourdieu's mm-hmm. concept of the official and then the unofficial or subordinated culture.
Popular.
Yeah, subordinated and popular, I think, are meant to go together in that regard.
Yes.
But I think that even within the popular culture, then you get a replication of that order.
Right.
Yes.
And I mean, I think you get it at both tiers, but you definitely get that, you know, that no, we're the ones who know this fandom better. And I mean, that's where you get the discrimination
mm-hmm.
working. And it's because people still want they want to have some kind of power in whatever space they can operate in.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, he says, I think it's on page 43, he talks about the fans' power over and participation in the text, and it's like, he compares the Rocky Horror fan who knows every single line and, you know, can recite it all and participate and rewrite and restructure the text versus the Shakespeare buff who may know the lines equally as well, but sort of approaches it in a different way and uses it to distinguish between, for instance, like, what's the best performance of this, you know?
Right. But he conveniently leaves out, you know, Wide Sargasso Sea and Tom Stoppard, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
What I was going to say is, like, what we were just talking about here is, like, the textual knowledge is used to discriminate.
In the same way.
And he says that's used only in the dominant, but I think it's used in the popular.
Yeah, it is.
Fandoms as well, where it's like, you don't know this source as well as I do, let me show you, mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Right. Or you're a noob.
Well, so here's a question.
Noob.
So I have a question, because then he goes on and talks about collecting and a couple of different things. But I have a question written down here, which is that, do you think that fans sort of ape the official sort of form of the fandom that they're in? So, like, for example, he brings up the point of comic books and people talking about sort of the artistic value of the comic book and the literary value of the story, all right, the image and the story together. Whereas in a lot of, say, text-based fandoms, like when you're writing fan fiction, people do ascribe value to better writers. I mean, I was on LiveJournal just the other day bitching about how, you know, this person clearly needs a beta and, you know, they'd be mm-hmm. a good writer if they had somebody to beta for them. And I didn't recommend the fic because it was just a pain to read, even though there were a lot of good ideas in it.
Right.
And, you know, so people, I think that in different fandoms, the different types of fandoms, people reach for sort of the official high aesthetic language and process
mm-hmm.
and bring them down or bring them across or bring them out or whatever. Bring
translate them.
Translate and transform them into fanish behavior and sort of how we ascribe value in fandom.
I mean, maybe though, are we approaching this as people who are relatively high, like we said, relatively high cultural capital people to start with? I mean, my feeling, and I guess I can't speak to this because I was not ever a teenager in fandom in the
you
same
were never
way.
A teenager? Oh, yeah.
I was never a teenager in online fandom, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because it didn't exist, really. Or, you know, I hadn't found it. But my sense is that we, because we're, you know, what's the word I want to use? Do we want to call ourselves middle-aged? I don't know if I'm middle-aged yet, but anyway.
I'm not middle-aged. Hey, I'm in my 20s.
Older fans.
You guys are all geriatric.
Who are coming at this with a sort of degree of education and sophistication or whatever are going to be more choosy and are going to say, you know, I'm just not going to read this if it's got bad grammar or whatever. But when you're in that sort of teenage enthusiastic, I just want everything to do with this, I'll read everything. You may not
I definitely read everything.
I think you don't discriminate as choosily, perhaps.
So you think this
you aren't as discriminating.
Thing.
Yes.
I've got personal examples that can speak to this. As I know I have spoken before about my early forays into video game, again, based fandoms and how that started. I think I've told that story before. Well, basically, it started on a mailing list it started on in news group. Then moved to a mailing list. And when these interactive stories started out, really there was no, like, anyone could join in. You just had to write and then people just went with it. It was not organized at all. And then sort of as it progressed, because these went on, I think the two of them that I was involved with both went on for about maybe 5 years total. Like, over time, not only did the people who were engaged in it expect better from the people who they were writing with, like, so we as mm-hmm. participants began to demand that other writers put more care into their compositions. But new people who were coming into our story also needed to meet certain standards in terms of, you know, are they creating something original? If they are creating something original, does it fit within, you know, the world as it has evolved to that point? If they're using another character, like, can they fit that character into this world in a reasonable way. You know, how well do they actually write? Like we eventually established a submission process where people would have to apply to write either for particular characters or for original characters or whatnot. But you had to prove that you could write and that you had ideas and that you had specific ways that you were going to bring these characters in to engage with the broader world. So not only did we as fans become more critical over time, but the fandom itself developed higher standards as it evolved.
I mean, and did you do that because of bad experiences? Like,
yes.
I assume because of having let in people that proved to be, you know, either disruptive or just not really fitting in with the group or whatever.
All of the above. We got people who are really bad writers, people who had ideas that just didn't fit in the setting that they wanted to write, and you know, there was at first there was no real policing in terms of what people could do, and so in the early stuff we were sort of left with all this legacy of really weird story like things that had happened canonically in our story that we then had to figure out how to rationalize what had happened there and what was going on and whether or not we could connect it or just wanted to ignore it or what. So we ended up having to work with that. And then we put one person in charge, and we put like a trio of people who are sort of in charge of managing the overall storyline and of letting certain people know how to engage with it and what was going on. And, you know, somebody else was in charge of actually approving different characters and so forth.
Yeah,
and so it became
it's like peer review on an academic journal in
yeah
some ways.
And it,
you have outside reviewers and you have an editor and
yeah, and like when I started that, I was in high school. By the time they died, I was in my early university years. I was in my undergrad. And so I think like it was interesting to me because like not only were the personal standards evolving, but the fandom as well as it became
right
more established.
And I've seen that in different fandoms that I've read in, where some fandoms have a wide range of good, mediocre, and bad, and then some are just so consistently good that you're like, I sometimes am just intimidated, like I'm not sure I want to write a story for that fandom because all the writers I've read so far are amazing, and then other ones where you're like, I can write a better story than that. That's
I think that self-policing you see in other fandoms as well. I know that when these sort of Avengers movies started coming out, I have a friend, a very good fanish friend, and whereas other people were sort of jumping into their new fandom willy-nilly, she essentially didn't let herself until she could sit down and process and read and sort of understand all the Avengers backstory. She had never read any comic books, never read any graphic novels, had never touched the genre, and then she wanted to write about Black Widow. So she's like, okay, I'm not going to do this until I understand exactly everything that's going on.
Right.
So there may be a sort of like self-policing at a certain level of stuff that happens.
But I think it's related to then, I think, to somewhat to this cultural capital idea of where if you're going to do a nosedive and look bad in front of everyone, you're going to try to avoid that. And you want to...
Well, you want to create a gift that's going to be appropriately... if you are putting yourself out there, literally...
Right.
You are going to want to make sure, like, if you have a better understanding of how fandom works, you're going to want to make sure that it's going to be a gift that's appreciated and valued by other people so that you're not exposing yourself to potential harm.
Yeah. So I think that's sort of the cultural capital is regulating behavior in that respect.
I just thought of this now, but I think it would make for an interesting discussion if we want to keep going for a little bit longer. The idea of anonymous memes and this...
The anonymous love meme or...
Or kink memes. Yeah.
Mm.
Well, porn battle's not necessarily anonymous, but...
I guess not.
But yeah, like
but
kink memes and so on.
Yeah.
So where you have... I mean, you're still putting yourself out there, but there's a certain level of protection there. And it's interesting to me not only that people... like want that protection in terms of what they're asking for and what they're writing, like, you know, being, you know, that's too extreme for me, that's not something I want to be associated with, but then
and
like,
also I've seen
but they still know that the, when they see responses to it, if people are give positive responses back, they still get that feeling of reward. Even if nobody knows who they are, you still get a certain amount of return on your investment of everyone thought that was awesome.
And you sort of get to troubleshoot like, hey, I have a couple paragraphs of this idea. Let's see how this plays, and then I'll keep posting if it works out, right? And then sometimes it, you know, people just, you know, they de-anonymous.
They de-anon. Yeah.
Yeah, they'll just say, I'm posting this now.
Yeah, I've certainly seen that where if a story sort of, especially if a story is well-received, that then you're like, oh, well, now I'm going to post it on AO3 under my vanished name. So
And I mean, it's interesting because in some cases, like, I haven't participated in a lot of them, but I have watched other people participate in them. And you kind of get a sense of, like, watching people's patterns, you know, who's writing for what pairings and whatnot. And if you're likely, if you prompt for certain stuff, what people are likely to respond to that.
Yeah.
And you might not necessarily know exactly who they are, but you'll know, like, oh, I bet you that's the same person who wrote this other fic. Or
I can certainly say that in, at least in Song of Ice and Fire fandom, like, 5 years ago, when there was a kink meme going on, I could usually make a guess at who the writers were just because there were relatively few writers at that time and I knew a lot of them and had read a lot of their stories, so I could have a reasonable guess, you know, who's likely to write this pairing or who would be more likely to write this, you know, this character versus that one or whatever. You know, I'm sure I didn't always guess right, but, you know, when it's a relatively closed and small fandom like that, the anonymousness of it is kind of a front, I think.
Fair.
Yeah.
But it does change, I think, the nature of the kind of cultural capital you get, because you get that sense of self-validation.
Right.
But you don't necessarily have something to ride on. Or it's like Aera said, you get that pre-vetting, you know, of, is this going to be something that I can then risk putting out there?
Right.
It's like having a... like a beta release, really, of your fic, so to speak.
I mean, I think I think that applies to a lot of comment fic in general, though, not necessarily even just anonymous ones, but ones where you can say, oh, I just dashed this off really quick and, you know, I hope you like it. And if it gets a good reception and people do like it, then maybe you go and develop it more or you polish it up more and then post it, you know, more formally. I think the medium of the comment fic encourages that kind of casual, this is unbated and I haven't, you know, so forgive any mistakes and I hope you like it kind of thing. That sort of casual writing off the cuff.
And you're still participating, especially in comment fic, very much in that gift culture.
Yeah.
Right.
Where you're still providing, you know, you're literally giving it to someone in response to something that they have posted. So it's very much that reciprocal gifting idea again.
Right. And we didn't really get into the whole idea of people who actually make money off of this. And I know we talked about it already with the 50 Shades of Grey discussion in a previous episode, but there is a whole issue.
Or the Cassandra Clare discussion. Or the,
we've talked about it a bit.
A bit. So, but that is, a certain aspect that came up in both of these articles, is that once people start profiting from it, it loses its fan cachet.
Any attempt to convert the sort of cultural capital to the economic capital is viewed with suspicion.
Right.
Both Fisk and Hellickson essentially put it in those terms.
And I think the one exception that I notice that happens kind of frequently is the charity auction.
Yeah.
Where people are like, I'm trying to raise money for this cause, so I'll write you a story if you donate this much money to this charity, which I think is an interesting...
Yeah, but I mean, there's still...
So it incorporates money into the equation, but the writer is not profiting from it, so that's okay. But then I've seen fan artists who will essentially take a commission, and that's okay. Like, if you're like, I want a picture of Agent Gibbs and Agent Dinozzo having sex, and they're like, all right, give me $50, I'll make you this picture. But, like, for some reason, that's okay, but not, you know, I want you to write me a story about that, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of why I could, like, it tracks. Like, I would consider that okay, whereas if someone was like, please write me this story, I'll give you $50, I probably wouldn't. I think part of it may just be the sort of the value that art holds over, not art, but that visual media holds over textual media. I know that I am not an artist in any sense of the word, but especially in the fact that I can't draw for shit. And I don't know how to work
a specialized skill.
Yeah. Like, I can't do anything with a computer or the vids or any, and it's like this, ooh, look at this. Right?
Right.
I think I think that you're right that there is a skill. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt if you
were. No. I was just me trailing off.
Okay, that's what
trying
I
to figure out where I was going, but I don't really have any other justification. I don't really have any other justification.
I have it.
You
I
do.
Have,
go.
I have my potential justification is that it is really, let me try and think of it, how to say it, that it is a legacy from other forms of fandom.
Mm-hmm.
For example, at science fiction fantasy conventions where you would have an artist's table.
Ah.
Right.
So it's not necessarily coming into media fandom from the same avenues, maybe, that this is a behavior that was accepted previously in other contexts
and I think,
of fandom.
I think for legal reasons, too. I mean,
yes,
fan art is a pretty safe ground. You're not super likely to get sued for drawing, you know, pictures of a character.
Unless it's Mickey Mouse.
But I think, therefore, historically, it's been okay for fan artists to charge for their work.
Right.
And
why you get them at this convention. So, yeah.
And exactly. And to sell them at conventions and, you know, and have them published in official books and whatever. You know, there's whole books of fan art that... I'm thinking of the Art of Ice and Fire one that basically melds together fan art with official art, with stuff from the calendars, with stuff from the card game that was like officially sanctioned, you know, art done by professionals, with stuff that was done by amateurs for fan purposes.
Right.
Oh, fun story. Did I tell you about the Queen of Denmark?
No.
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 She's a Tolkien fan artist.
Okay.
No, she like actually she read Tolkien's books and then drew a bunch of pictures and sent them to Tolkien, and Tolkien was like, "That's awesome, lady. Who are you?" And she was like, "Queen of Denmark."
Yo, Queen of Denmark, yo.
That's pretty cool.
That's
just drawing
you
some elves,
awesome.
Yo. I don't know. Maybe she liked the Hobbits better.
But she was one of his favorites. I mean, yeah, Tolkien had favorite fan artists. Like, you know, there were people that he couldn't stand, but there were other people whose art he felt better captured the sort of the experience of Middle Earth than his own,
right.
and so he was very welcoming and very sort of, he had people use them in productions through, you know, I think it was a Russian guy who they did for the Russian sort of printing of the Lord of the Rings and the Danish and all this stuff. So
yeah.
I think people, they see them as less threatening.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they're not trying to do the same thing, a.k.a.
And I think maybe that's why the Mickey Mouse thing, I mean, obviously Disney has, you know, sort of trademark issues there, but
yes,
because it's also a visual media, it's perceived as being more in competition with the other visual media. And I don't know what the situation is in, for instance, something like comic book art. Like, is it generally accepted in comic book fandom to draw your own versions of the characters and... You know,
I don't know. It is for anime. Like, anime people do it all the time, and
yeah.
That's a visual.
And they do porn of it too. Like, doujinshi is definitely out there, and
oh yeah,
and it's out there, man.
Sorry. and sometimes yummy.
And I'm not sure what sort of legal ramifications they face. I mean, I'm not sure what the rules are in other countries, but I know in America, like, there people do bring suits. You know, claiming that this, you know, sort of dilutes the image, or, you know, they bring it for moral reasons, although that isn't as common anymore. But, you know, if it was the 1970s and you were doing a gay Batman, you know, fan comic and tried to sell it, I don't see that going over very well.
Yeah.
Right. But then it also depends on how widely you're trying to sell it. If you're just selling it at a table at a con, you're probably not going to get busted.
That's why the internet ruined everything. Why the internet sort of changed everything. If you're selling it at a con, who's going to know? If you're on the internet and they can just Google, and these, you know, DC, Warner Brothers, they have lawyers who do this.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
They have people out there looking for copyright violations.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's interesting that fandom has sort of evolved to accommodate these legal strictures on what they can do. So we've come to say gift exchange is the great thing. This is all, you know, this is super important to our culture as fans, when it's kind of something that's also imposed on us by legal requirement.
Yeah, well, Hellickson essentially points out that sort of the anti-commercial nature is a type of legal protection.
Yeah.
And that the fact that the gift economy does have this exclusionary factor to it can also act as a protection as well. Right, people are suspicious of people as they immediately come into fandom unless they follow sort of like an easily understandable fanish narrative, like, hey, I was watching this show and I totally think these two characters should make out. Is this where we talk about that? But if people just start coming in and trying to capitalize off of fandom, then people are immediately suspicious, and that acts in favor of fandom's sort of legal status.
Yep.
Okay. It's time for that fabulous time of the podcast when everyone picks an awesome, awesome fic that everyone else should read. So who wants to go first?
I'll go first.
Yay!
All right. So the story I want to rec is called Azure's Consort, and it's by Lil the Hunger. It's for a series of books called The Books of the Raxura by Martha Wells, which is a really good series. And I highly recommend it. The reason I like this fic, it gives a backstory to a character who in the canon is kind of a grumpy old man, basically. he's like the grandpa kind of character of many of the younger people in the book. And this is kind of exploring his youth and his main romantic relationship, basically, how he became the character that we know and love in the books. And one of the things I really, really like about it, aside from I think that Lil the Hunger really does a great job on capturing the setting and sort of the tone of the interactions between the characters, although it's set at an earlier period, it feels very believable as an earlier sort of version of the culture that we see in the books. But one thing that I really like that she does is she essentially shows the parallels between Stone, this sort of grandpa type character, except when he's young, and the main character of the books. And you can see things that I didn't really fully grasp when I was reading them, like how similar they are in some ways and why Moon, who's the main character of the books, and Stone get along so well, because in some ways they're really, really similar. And she does a great job of illustrating that, I think, and showing the parallels without explicitly saying, you know, this is how they're the same. It felt like reading a prequel where you could say, okay, this is how this stuff came to be the way it is in the books. So that was why I liked it, and
yay.
It is a good story. People should read it. But they should probably read the book, at least the first book, first, if they want to understand it.
Right. Fair enough. Okay, next.
I'll go next. So I am reading, I've already read, and I'm going to rec a story that is actually the third story in a series. And this is, I'm looking at the wrong one. It's For the Duration by Narat. And this is a story in the Charioteer fandom. Which is a book by Mary Renault. And this series of stories focuses on a non-canonical pairing of Ralph Lanyon and Andrew Rains, who, if you have read the book, which I actually have not, they are apparently the two edges of the triangle that focuses on another character. And in this series that Narat has written, that character has died tragically, essentially, and that death has brought together the two ends of the triangle. And so that circumstance happens, I guess, earlier in the series that she's written. But as I said, I'm wrecking the third section, because this is the part that I read first. And I have, as I said, I've never read The Charioteer. I know a little bit about it because I have friends who sort of dabble in the fandom, or who are more involved in the fandom, i.e. at all, than me. But I read this story because I do know Narat online, and I know that she's an excellent writer. And I was like, well, I kind of want to see what you've done, because I know that she's been working on it for a long time and whatever. So I thought, I'll just give it a shot. But I found that even not knowing the backstory of how these particular characters have gotten together and not really knowing the backstories of what had happened to them in the book and what had happened with this other man, that the relationship that is presented in this section of the story is really understandable. It comes across very clearly. The characters are very well defined. The writing is excellent. The characterizations are very subtle. She does a lot with just like casual phrasing that gets a lot of meaning across, and it deals with some really interesting subject matter. The story itself, the book is set during World War II, and basically all the men in it are gay men. So it has a lot of that, you know, what was it like to be queer in right. Britain during World War II, and so on and so forth. And one of the main characters in the story, Ralph, is in the Navy, and apparently he was wounded at one point, and so he's not in active service anymore. And the other character in this pairing is actually Quaker, and he was, well, crap, I can't remember the name for it, but he's a pacifist.
A conscientious objector.
Yes, a conscientious objector. So they have that dynamic in it. And in this story, what happens is that Andrew decides that he's going to join the Royal Army Medical Corps as a non-combatant to basically be in the ambulance, like the paratrooping mm-hmm. ambulance people.
As you
so,
do.
So like he's a paratrooping medic. And so, you know, this is difficult for them for various reasons. Like, Ralph isn't really sure how, you know, he feels like he's having an influence on Andrew's values, and he's not sure what he thinks about that. Like, there's a lot of tensions between them about, you know, how they feel about their roles in the war. There's issues with long-distance relationships and how both of them view what their own relationship is, and what it's like to participate in that gay culture of the time, and so on and so forth. And there's a lot of really just interesting, subtle things that happen in the story that she gets across really clearly. And as I said, like, I don't know anything about, or I didn't know anything about these characters going into the story, but I still felt like I could access them enough, and that their relationship was deep and detailed enough that it was still really interesting and engaging and well done. So I liked it. And then I went back and read the other parts, which are also good, but I thought that this one was especially excellent.
Yay! That sounds awesome.
Okay. It really Great. Is. So that was a long rec, but there you go. It's a long story.
Okay. I think, is it okay with me going, Laconi?
Yep, go for it.
All right. So it's happened. Hockey RPS on Fictherpology. It was going to happen at some point. I figure we may as well pop that cherry now.
Yeah,
that's right. This fic that I am going to rec is probably my favorite fic in hockey fandom, although there are several others that come super close. It's called Tour de Force by The Hoyden on AO3, and it chronicles the adventures of one Blackhawks player, Patrick Kane, as he becomes a best-selling young adult novelist unbeknownst to anybody else in his life. It's amazing. So for those of you who don't know, Patrick Kane plays right wing for the Chicago Blackhawks. And this year he's been having a firecracker of a season. But last year was not so good for him or the Blackhawks. They had a particularly bad year. Their center, Jonathan Toews, got a concussion. And at the end, Patrick Kane had to try and play center. And at the end of the season, he kind of went off the deep end. This is real life, guys. He ended up drinking his way through a college town and doing a lot of stupid shit. And a whole flurry of fics were written after this about how Patrick Kane comes back from being basically the douchiest guy on the internet for a solid month. And I like this fic because, you know, he's dealing with, he's essentially getting his frustrations, the character is getting his frustrations out through writing. And underneath all of his frustrations are his fears about failure, his fears about being traded, his fears about injury, his fears about not playing well enough. And these fears come out through his writing. And underneath all the fear, it turns out that there's a lot of love. perhaps the best part of this fic is, so I mentioned the center, Jonathan Taves. He is the guy that Patrick Kane is most often shipped with. They are the big OTP of hockey fandom. And Patrick Kane, when he writes the book, bases the two main characters on himself and his best friend, the center, Jonathan Taves, without realizing that he's doing it necessarily. And so he writes one book and it sells like hotcakes, and then he's writing the second book and his editor has to sit him down and be like, "So, are you writing a gay romance novel? Because we'll work with that. But you don't seem confident that you're writing a gay romance novel." And Patrick Kane has to be like, "What? There's no gay romance in this." And his editor has to explain to him that no, this is not how normal people interact. And then Patrick Kane has his whole awakening where he's like, "Wait, I'm in love with Johnny. How did I not know?" Which is a very common thing in hockey fandom because they're all pretty self-unaware. And and it's utterly adorable. And my favorite part is when everyone figures out that Patrick is the one that has been writing these novels, and one of the other teammates is like, "Man, I can't believe I wrote you fan mail."
Awesome.
Pretty much.
Sweet. Okay, is that up? Is it me?
Yep, you're up.
It's you. Bring us home, baby.
I do have to point out that the Hoyden also wrote an absolutely adorable NCIS fic called Interrogative, which I will minorly recommend. Not that it's minorly recommendable. It's just that wasn't going to be my main recommendation. But since you brought her up already, I have to say it's adorable. They're stuck in a B&B in Maine in a snowstorm. And, you know.
And gay shit happens.
Yeah.
I love that!
But like, the way Gibbs stays in character and is all gruff and stuff, even though he's, macking on Tony, is kind of adorable. Because it's hard to get Gibbs to do the sappy without having him sound sappy, because he's not sappy. He's not. But, I digress. I was going to recommend a fic from a previous Yuletide, I think it was 2011, called Force Majeure. By Astolat.
Yes.
Which I love. I don't have a huge backstory to explain or anything. It's basically George Washington and Alexander Hamilton. So there's that kind of weirdness factor of like, what's going on with our forefathers? And it's sort of based on the universe created by in the books Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, the kind of magic exists in the real world, and so it kind of has Alexander Hamilton as a magician and then George Washington trying to figure out how to use him to win the war against the British, and then they have to bond a lot and spend a lot of time together, and then they have some weird like magical excursion to another world where sex may or may not happen, and so I don't know, part of the reason I love it was just because it was so wackadoo, but it's also amazingly well written, and it convinces you that this could totally make sense in some world, and so that's it for me. I really don't have much else to say except read it. It's fun. And I guess that's it for episode 5. Are we on 5?
Yeah,
I think it, yeah, episode 5. Thanks for joining us. And thank you to all of our participants.
Yay.
Bye, guys.
Bye.